Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The West Ukraine propaganda machine has begun to crack. The reality on the battlefield is at odds with the tightly guarded messaging fed to Western publics. A few courageous voices say the obvious. Ukraine should negotiate now while it still has something to negotiate with. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He is a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the new book, Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And here in Moscow, we have Maxim Suchkov. He is the director of the Center for Advanced American Studies at Moscow State Institute of International Relations. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start out with Oslo. Glenn, over the last few news cycles, and I'm thinking of the New York Times editorial piece that actually questioned the goals that the Biden administration has in Ukraine and de facto NATO's goals. The Washington Post published an article about volunteers, not regular army, but volunteers in Ukraine's military forces that are treated quite badly, ended up leaving the field and being arrested for desertion. And then we have the big name of them all, Henry Kissinger, at the Davos setting, and just basically saying, you better wrap this up quickly through negotiations or it's going to start unraveling for everyone involved. So my question is to you, is this going to have an impact on policymaking or is it just double down, triple down?
Well, I think there will be more and more opposition once the war is not going Ukraine's way. So obviously for a long time now, for many weeks, Russia has been grinding down the Ukrainian army and Russia has been making a lot of victories. However, in the past 3-4 weeks now, we see that things became very critical. The last time we spoke, I mentioned that the main key front lines in Ukraine has collapsed and they're now encircling these huge pockets of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers. So it's hard to ignore this. You can't really spin the story anymore as a victory. So this is why there's becoming a lot of pressure now on within the West on trying to find some kind of an agreement with Russia. Because it begs the question, what is the objective if we can't make a settlement with the Russians? Because if the alternative is a bad deal today or an even worse deal tomorrow for the West, then logic would dictate that we would make a deal today. And given that Washington doesn't seem interested still not to make a deal, it begs the question, is there an alternative objective? And obviously there have been a lot of voices in Washington from the administration suggesting that the goal is, to break Russia's back, to weaken it. So there's many who's concerned that this, if the mission is to create a new Afghanistan in Ukraine and try to weaken the Russian for a longer period of time, is this indeed a pro-Ukrainian policy, or are we simply fighting the Russians to the last Ukrainian and essentially sacrificing that country? I think that the positions have been artificially positioned as being either pro-Russian or pro-Western, but one has to ask the question, what is the purpose of this now? And I think these voices are increasing, and at some point, I guess they will have some influence in Washington. Indeed, even the New York Times has come out now. So it's something is changing, we're still, I think, far away from a change in policy in Washington.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. How is this to the advantage of the Ukrainians? Well, Max, there is one element, one caveat that many in the Ukrainian political elite would find as a positive is all this huge amounts of money being thrown at them from the West. I mean, now if we put all in, it's like $53 billion from the United States. And then we have the European Union. I don't know the exact numbers, but I mean, they're going through what $5 to $7 billion a month to pay salaries and the military and all that. I mean, if you're in, you're Zelensky and you're in that circle and this is in the middle of a conflict where They have foreign leaders waltzing around downtown Kyiv without a care. That's what I call the grift. Why wouldn't Ukraine want to keep that grift going as long as it possibly can? Go ahead, Max.
Well, I think for right now, the West has to deal with three challenges kind of lumped together. One is the challenge of dealing with the leadership in Kyiv per se, who are asking for more money and more military hardware. And I think there is this understanding that have started to trickle down among the minds of Western elites that it's really a black hole that is soaking up resources without clear implications for Western public and for Western security and for Western political objectives. The second one is, of course, on how you deal with Russia, you know, kind of post-conflict. And we've seen this proposal coming from Italy, and you know, we need to think about European security architecture. While I personally think that the very proposal is kind of the ship that has sailed, there isn't much worth to it. It still is interesting sign, very different from what we've seen over the past few weeks on the very thinking patterns among some of the Western countries. And finally, you know, the Western leadership has to deal with the immediate implications of this conflict and confrontation with Russia for their own domestic constituencies and globally. And it's getting harder to explain what are the clear objectives, you know, and you know, this message of Putin's price hike and stuff like this isn't really flying well with many constituencies in the West, in the US in particular. And there is even some suggestions that, you know, Emmanuel Macron may perhaps be the last of the current Western leadership cohort who've got reelected. Others may be voted out of office quickly, which is a stark difference from President Putin, who I should remark to our audience is, in my view, operating more in the paradigm of a quote-unquote historic leader than a classic Western politician. You know, he doesn't really have to care much about re-election. He doesn't really have to care much about the stuff that Western politicians have to care about. So this, in a way, empowers him to think that he can act.
That assumes that he has courage and wisdom. I agree with you completely. He's got it all teed up. He's got it all there. But will he do it? And everything we've seen about him so far tells us he won't. Okay, but I agree with
that.
Glenn, let me go back to you. In a sense, this whole Ukrainian gambit for the U.S. and the U.K., because they seem to be an axis here driving this, both countries that are not in the European Union, interestingly enough. And their unity of Europe is almost seamless for now. And that's why they need a breakthrough to keep that unity together. The longer this goes on, even the Kyiv government has admitted their losses in the east. They won't say specifically, but they're admitting it's not going so well here. So, I mean, if the purpose was to unify the West in the European sense around behind the U.S. and behind the U.K. as leaders of NATO, They need a breakthrough one way or another because of, you know, baby formula, energy crisis, migration. I mean, you can keep the fever pitch up for a while emotionally, but now things are beginning to settle down. We're seeing reports in Germany, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland about migration and things like that, where the welcome mat is not so welcoming as time goes on. So, I mean, there's been a kind of a critical breakthrough, but is it sustainable without a quote-unquote win in Ukraine?
Well, no, I think that was the problem. I think this unity of NATO, which we heard so much about, it was premised on a victory over Russia. But as we've seen, the battlefield hasn't played out as expected. The economic war against Russia hasn't panned out as expected. Indeed, there's a huge boomerang effect. There were the European economies are now suffering greatly. And, this whole story of Russia being this gas station masquerading as a country, this is I think we deceived ourselves in the West by buying into this. So I think that, again, the solidarity was premised on victory. But now that this doesn't seem to be the case anymore, I think you will see it fragment more, because now we're looking at how the costs are affecting us, and also who are paying the higher cost, and And if there's no clear objective behind this, and again, as I mentioned, if the goal of the United States and Britain is to, well, maybe, you know, Donbass is lost, you know, we can sacrifice thousands of Ukrainian soldiers there, but at least buy some time to train up a new army in Western Ukraine and have these waves of continuous attacks to wear down Russia over time. To what extent is this in the European interest? So I think that we see the commitment to this narrative of victory as well is collapsing. Again, I don't want to denigrate the Ukrainian soldiers. They fought very well. They've been well trained, well armed, everything. However, this narrative in the beginning was very distant from reality. If you remember, you had this martyrs on the Snake Island, you know, until they popped up on Russian TV being alive. You had this ghost of Kyiv who shot down 40 Russian jets. I mean, it became ridiculous, but still, that's not how wars work. But still, this was just sold as a fact. And now, of course, it was a few weeks ago now that Mariupol fell. And that, you know, they came out also when the Ukrainian soldiers, they surrendered, hands in air, unconditional surrender, going into Russian captivity. And how was this covered in the Western media? Well, we wrote it was an evacuation. Like, how do you evacuate from battlefield into a Russian prison? It doesn't make any sense. So we're reinventing the language to keep the narrative alive. So I think now that the losses are coming in, and some are having second thoughts, I see that the commitment to the narrative is cracking. And with that, I expect that the solidarity within NATO will begin to wither away as well.
You know, Max, one of the biggest problems with the Western mindset in looking at what's going on in the conflict in Ukraine is that they expect it to be done like in an American way or a NATO way. And if you look at Russia's military efforts in Ukraine, knowing something about Russian military history, it's just the long grind to victory. Okay, it's not flamboyant. It's, you know, they're not looking for headlines. They're just methodically doing what they always do, from the Red Army taking Berlin, some would say Grozny, what we saw with the conflict in South Ossetia. It's remarkably similar, but it's not American or NATO or Western in performance. Go ahead, Max.
I would also add to that that throughout its history, Russia has barely entered any conflict well-prepared. You know, it's always had big issues in the beginning, even against, adversaries that appear to be much weaker. So there is nothing new in the terms of how, you know, the sort of obstacles that Russia has encountered. Now it has changed a lot. I would also focus that, you know, pick up on something that Glenn's mentioned, this constant pursuit of trying to reinvent the life to keep the narrative going. And that, I think, is a kind of a dark reality of the information warfare, that you can win as many...
The dark reality of information warfare, we're going to stop on that point here. We're going to go to a quick break. And after that quick break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
The sanctions package bars Russian-flagged vessels from entering EU ports.
Belgium, Bulgaria, Lithuania, Romania, Estonia and Italy were the first to announce that their ports would be closed to Russian ships.
Now there's talk of rerouting oil and gas exports to Asia.
Возможность отправить в Индию это вот как раз только морем.
Плюс море едешь в любую страну.
The eastern part of the Northern Sea route has never been used year-round.
На этих ледоколах уже возможно. Настолько мощный, что его ничем не остановить.
Впервые в истории Северный морской путь в России станет морской дорогой.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Max here in Moscow. You were talking about information warfare before we went to our hard break. Continue, my friend.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, you may win as many info battles if you as you wish, you know, create as many fakes as you want and talk about the dominance in information warfare, but the reality check of the battlefield would come back to haunt you one day, and you will have hard time explaining to your own constituencies of how, you know, about how on earth this turned out the way it turned out, whereas you told them it would have been different. I also would say that, you know, one of the major things that is now, of course, evolving this the risk of global famine and starvation, and the narrative that has now been shaped up, as I can see, is to shift the blame for this to Russia. And I think it's important to know that Ukraine's share in the global production of wheat is 11.5%, whereas that of Russia is 16.8%. So the attempt to focus on Russia blocking the Odessa port being the main reason for potential global famine, without talking about how Russia's own supply chains of wheat being disrupted, including through sanctions, that is actually the major driver of what the problem in the wheat market, is also another thing that will come back to haunt those who propel these narratives, I think, sometime in the fall.
Yeah, it's interesting, Glenn, because I've been following this quote-unquote Russia's war on food supply here, which is absolutely absurd. I mean, if we look at the exit points in the Black Sea, these are all been mined by the Ukrainian government. Actually, on the day of the conflict that started, they mined these ports here. And there's also talk, I guess, is the next threat, a possible military or non-military solution of escorts and things like that. When I listen to the British government, Liz Truss, I mean, she just keeps you entertained every step of the way here. I mean, she's so divorced from reality, it makes her potentially very dangerous here. But there's always looking for a wedge that doesn't, and at the same time, it's just a part of the information war. It's just a shame. But, you know, the British are saying, well, we won't get involved in it, but other people should do it. I mean, again, you know, I think the biggest question for me in this program here is that how are they going to accept defeat? Glenn, how do they come to terms with that? Because the way I look at it is that possibly, and future historians will tell us, I suppose, is that, you know, 1 month in the conflict, there was talks in Istanbul, and it looked like possible movement, and then that suddenly, okay? People say it was Boris Johnson, there were other people that were influencing Zelensky. But ever since then, it's Russia's timetable, and Russia will say when it's over. I mean, because if you don't have an interlocutor, then you have no other choice but to make your own unilateral facts on the ground decisions. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, and again, so I have a different view of what the pro-Ukrainian policy should be, which is stop making Ukraine pay all the cost of this escalation. And keep in mind, if you go back one step, well, what Russia really wanted was for NATO to stop expanding. If we would get some concessions on the Western side, let's say the West now stepped up to Russia, say, listen, we promise no NATO expansion, not even to Sweden or Finland, but then we want some concessions in Ukraine. Then they could get a good deal without the Ukrainians paying a high price in territory. But instead, we've seen this escalation all along. Keep in mind that for 7 years with the Minsk agreement, the agreement was merely to give autonomy to Donbas, which Russia was happy with. But after that deal was sabotaged for 7 years, Russia went in militarily and then said, well, if we, now that we're going militarily, Donbas will have independence. And again, you had the peace agreements, well, this diplomacy at least, in Istanbul, and they were reaching, still far away, but they were at least were moving towards some kind of an agreement. They had some common agreements, and then we saw that the British and Americans were pushing them to step away from and withdraw all the concessions they had committed themselves to. Now, at this point, the war keeps escalating, and now you see Russia is also, you know, it's has almost the entirety of Kherson, a huge part of the southern parts of Zaporizhia, and also much of Kharkov region as well. So so the longer we, if the United States and Britain want to keep this war going, the longer they delay it, the more territory I think Ukraine will lose. And this is, again, the way I see it is either a bad deal today for Ukraine or worse one tomorrow. But again, it all boils down to the idea of what is the objective. Are NATO and Americans pouring billions of dollars into Ukraine simply because they're, you know, good guys and want to help them out, or do they have other objectives? So I think, again, going back to this, now that these other objectives are becoming more obvious, I don't think necessarily that the Americans, Europeans, they all have the same objectives anymore. Again, from Europe's perspective, and Afghanistan here on the continent is not necessarily in our interest.
That's not a favorable idea. I don't. You can bandy it about on cable TV, but the reality of it is that you really want something like that on your borders in Europe. I mean, Europeans and Americans, you know, they tolerated that in Afghanistan and Iraq because it was just so far away, and the refugees went to Europe. They didn't go to the United States. But Max, I want to pick up on something that Glenn was saying. You know, Henry Kissinger, you know, in Davos said, you know, a negotiation should begin soon. Okay, that, you know, and I give credit to his geopolitical genius, okay, not his policies when he was in power, but I mean, he's a pretty smart guy. I think everyone would agree to that. Well, why should the Russians get involved in any negotiation? Just because of what Glenn just said. I mean, 7 to 8 years with the Donbass lying, deception, all of this, and that, now you really want to talk in good faith? For me, that's really hard. Okay, and plus, Russia has made a commitment here. It cannot lose. It cannot lose this. It's going to take whatever it wants. And the room for negotiation, I think, is closed. I think when the Russians decide what their security requirements are, that's what this all is about, everyone forgets. And when they decide that, well, then, you know, the other side's just going to have to eat humble pie because that's the way it is.
I think we've discussed, including over these microphones in the past, that this conflict is in a way a third major attempt to restructure European security order and the world order in general since the end of World War II. You know, during the Yalta Conference, Soviet Union together with US and UK negotiated the new terms for the world order as a winner. The second attempt to, you know, structure world order and European security order came after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, which then Soviet Union and earlier Russia negotiated as a virtual loser. Now there is a view to renegotiate those terms, and I'm pretty sure Russia won't stop until it negotiates the new terms for its own political participation through creating more favorable security outcomes as a winner.
Well, that's a brilliant way of looking at it. Glenn, reflect upon that here, because Max essentially more eloquently just kind of answered my question. Your answer was better than my question. So Glenn, I mean, are we seeing as a result here, because people are so honed in at the micro part of it here, but Max is just right. This is actually creating a new pan-European security order. That's what Russia asked before this happened, and now it's just going to make it happen. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think it's important to explore why the pan-European security architecture has been collapsing over the past 30 years. Now, Max put the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union in the same sentence, but one has to remember there's 2 years in between. So it was in Malta in 1989 when the Cold War was declared over, and exactly 2 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. Now, why was this interesting? Because when the Cold War was declared over in 1989, it was seen as being a compromise. Both sides coming to the table with diplomacy, they're resolving these differences, and thereafter you had all these agreements like the Charter of Paris for a New Europe, in which they said the New Europe should have no dividing lines, there should be indivisible security, you know, one side should not expand their security at the expense of the other. However, once the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, then you had the U.S. ambassador, the last U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, arguing that well, as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, you have this myth creation in the United States that the Cold War had been won and they should dictate the new Europe. And what was the new Europe? Well, the new Europe was one which would be organized around United States, one that would eventually include all of the continent, except the largest country, Russia. And, you know, as many leading Americans, politicians, ambassadors, academics, they all point out, well, this is going to go really wrong at some point, because if NATO only keeps expanding to the east, Russia will have to push back one day. And, you know, that time has come, and now we're having a devastating war in Europe. So this is, a lot of this goes back to this failure to establish a Cold War, a post-Cold War security architecture for Europe. And but I agree with Max. I think the idea that we viewed Russia as the loser of the Cold War, it kind of put a victor's peace in place, in which the U.S. would dictate all the terms, which meant we're creating a European architecture which Russia couldn't live with. One where the AMB treaty was abandoned, the INF treaty, one after another. All these treaties collapse as a consequence of NATO expanding towards the Russian borders. So I think if we want to solve this war in Ukraine, I would see it as a symptom or a consequence of this. I would say the best idea is go back to step one, have a look at the European security architecture. Is this really what brings stability on Europe? Having every year having a larger and larger gun closer to the head of Russia, it doesn't seem like a recipe for stability. And I think the Ukrainians are paying a heavy price for neglecting these security discussions we should have had in Europe over the past 30 years, which we never did.
And Max, we just closed it out here, last 45 seconds. Can Europe live with an outcome where Russia dictates its own security needs? Can Europe live with it?
Well, I don't think it can, but it will have to eventually if there is no other option on the table. And I think, as I mentioned before, other more quote-unquote peaceful options have sailed when the West declined to talk about Russia's security proposals in early December. And that's very unfortunate, but I guess that's the reality of today.
Yeah, doing this program ever since those documents, one to NATO, one to the United States, I made program after program after program warning this is going to happen. And you know what, gentlemen, it happened. Maybe they should have listened to me, okay, for once. Okay, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.